Well, happy Shabbat, everyone. Welcome to Yada Yah Radio. My pleasure to be with you. Interesting day today. Parts of what made it interesting is that this morning, sometime around 6 o'clock this morning, as you know, I'm battling with the water police here, so I'm trucking in my water, and get a new driver, and the new driver, kind of a crusty old guy, but nice enough. And we start talking, and he says, you know, I'm told by the other drivers that you do a radio program. I said, yeah, I do. And the guy that told him is my regular water delivery guy. He's taking a political science class at the local university. And the professor, you'll like this, Larry, is Iranian. He was fired from the UC, the University of California system, because of his teaching, which was not politically correct. And so he went to the community college, where he can do and say whatever he wants. And in the political science class, it's about modern politics. The professor's primary debate starter is the Shattering Myth Show. Never met this guy. And he says, we said, we're going to use it because this is the only guy that actually, as an American, is willing to hold America accountable and knows the way the rest of the world is looking at America. And they go from the Ukraine to the, to Gaza, to Syria and Iraq and, the Iranian nuclear program, the whole nine yards. And it's just fascinating. So I finally, you know, I met this guy, they were talking about the class, and he says, my professor's going to die when he hears that I'm delivering water to the very guy that's doing
it. Yeah, wow,
that,
what are the odds on that?
That Shattering Myths show.
Yeah.
So anyway, so this other guy shows up this morning, and he says, you know, I was born religious. I was born a Mormon. And I said, I'm so sorry. And he says, why are you sorry? I said, because that's got to be the second most idiotic religion in the history of humankind. I mean, the only thing that would rival it in terms of stupidity would be Scientology. He's just looking at me, and he says, well, you know, I'm not...
Rastafari might give him a run.
Yeah, you know, I said, you know, I'm not a Mormon anymore. I said, well, that's good. I said, you know, there's just one statement you'd have to make to a Mormon. If the Mormon is capable of interacting with evidence and reason, all you need to tell the Mormon is that the premise of Mormonism is that Jews got on a big yacht around the time of Solomon, and they left Israel, and they sailed their big boat to the Americas, and they became the indigenous population. So I'm really not Sioux Indian, I'm Jewish. And I said, so, you know, they've come up with this thing called DNA now. And so they've checked the Native American descendants, not just the Sioux like myself, but the full gamut, all the way down through the Incas and the Aztecs and the Mayans, and they all have something in common. They're all from either Mongolia or Siberia. And there is not a hint of Jewish DNA amongst any of them, which means the premise of Joseph Smith was a lie. Now, if you're a Mormon and you're confronted with that and you do your due diligence and you say, yeah, that happens to be true, then you have to be a moron to remain a Mormon, which is probably why it's named Moronism. And, you know, he just looked at me and says, okay, yeah, well, glad I'm not a Mormon anymore. And we talked. This is just, what if I told you that God hates religion, but that God absolutely proved himself to you? So you say you're an agnostic now. What if I were to tell you that God absolutely proved his existence? I said, you've heard of relativity, right? And he says, yeah, I've heard of relativity. You know, the concept of relativity is that time does not flow equally in all places and in the presence of great mass or velocity, time slows. And he says, yeah, I'm familiar with that. Okay. What if I were to tell you that we know exactly how fast or slow time flowed at the Big Bang because we can measure the cosmic microwave radio degradation from the Big Bang? He said, oh, that makes sense. What if I were to tell you that time, the wave, is stretched 10 to the 12th power, and that if you were to multiply 14 billion years times 365 and a quarter days per year, and you divide it by 10 to the 12th, how long do you think creation took from the point of view of the Creator? And he says, you're telling me the answer is 6 days? I said, yeah, the answer is six.
It's shocking.
That is shocking. He says, how in the world have not heard of that before? That's shocking. And so I handed him a piece of paper. I wrote yadaya.com on it, and I said, you're going to want to read this. And he says, I will read it. That's how I started my day. That was a little after 6 this morning.
Well, that's a lovely way to start the day.
Yeah, so a lovely way to start the day, absolutely. And then, you know, we had IQ, Kirk, and Glenn all participating in Shattering Myths today. I have to tell you that, before I go on to the next meeting I had today, that Kirk's observation 2 or 3 days ago about an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is the way that we'll reconcile problems. And then his realization that the only difference between Yahweh's name and Yahusha's name is an eye and a tooth. You know, they're both Yod-Heh-Wah, which is the hand reaching down and out to us, the person standing, reaching up, looking up to God, and the Wah speaks of security and growth. But from there, rather than the final Hey that's in Yahweh's name, the final person standing up in Yahweh's name, in Yahusha's name you have just two things, an eye and a tooth. The eye is the ain, the tooth is the shin. And he says, so that's your resolution. And you hear something like that, and you just go, ooh, that was really smart. And the first thing he says, I wish I had thought of that. But you say, no, I'm actually glad I didn't think of it. I'm glad that somebody that I know thought of it and shared it. Now, moving to the second meeting. After I do the Shattering Myths show, it ends at Pacific time, right at lunchtime at 12. I head out, and I go to my favorite Friday place for lunch. And my favorite waiter comes up. He is Jewish by race, and we've talked in the past about his name and the Torah and all that sort of thing. And today he walks up and he says, "Let's talk about the condition of the world." He says, "I want to tell you something." He says, "As it turns out, my best friend roomed with your son at the local Christian college here. My son has spent 3 years." At a Christian college, fighting with all the professors, almost getting thrown out about 10 times. He was great at it. He was kind of interesting. Telford, the head of the religious studies, he took 2 of his classes, and Telford was the lead guy on the NILT, the New Living Translation, and Telford was responsible for the Old Testament and the NILT and the New Living Translation, and he was
a couple of brilliant copy editors there.
Oh my! And my son constantly gave him hell. You know, he'd make a statement, and my son said, "It's not true. This is what's true," and he would constantly, you know, he couldn't embarrass my son because my son didn't give a crap. But try to embarrass my son and belittle him in front of the class, and every time my son just would fire back and give him no quarter. And it was always fun to hear the arguments between the two, and they took place every day. So that was exciting. Anyway, so this kid says, you know, and we talked about his son, he says, oh, so you went to Westmont, so you're racially Jewish but religiously Christian. And he said, yes, so I switched immediately to Paul, and I said, what you need to do is read this book. It's called Questioning Paul, and you need to come to understand that there's a 0% possibility that Paul told the truth, and the religion of Christianity is based entirely on Paul, and since Paul lied about everything he said, you don't want to waste your soul being a Christian. And I'm talking out loud, and he's standing right here, and we're in this restaurant, and we go, oh, I said, oh, you know, are you to the place where if God's own testimony was wholly contradictory to Paul's, which it is, who are you going to believe? Who are you going to trust? Are you going to trust God or Paul when they're saying the opposite? You can't have both. And he's just, you know, swallowing hard. And I said, listen, I don't mean to give you a hard time, but you came up to me, you wanted to have this conversation. This is something you need to deal with. You know, you've been beguiled by your race and by your religion. So he walks away, and this woman in her late 20s comes up. She says, may I sit down? And
wow, this is turning into a good day.
Yeah, and she says, I'm an atheist.
Yeah.
I've studied, I've graduated in language and comparative religions, and also in physics.
Oh.
And she says, but I am an atheist. And she says, I don't know why I'm here, but I knew that was something that was just said here that is what little I overheard told me that I need to be here because there's something transformative about what you just said. I said, all right, well, first of all, if I am sorry to hear that you're an atheist because that takes way too much faith. And my concern is that what I have to say to you is not going to resonate because you're going to be too busy trying to defend atheism. But are you interested in evidence and reason? She said, okay, yeah. I said, now, you're way too young to have studied rhetoric. So you didn't study debate in school. That ended about the time I was in school, and I'm a whole lot older than you are. She says, no, I did not study rhetoric or debate. I said, but you're a physicist, so you understand probability, don't you? She says, yeah, I have an affinity for math. I said, okay, good. Are you willing to admit you're wrong if absolute, irrefutable evidence disproves your entire belief system? She says, yeah, I'd be willing to do that. I said, all right. Here, you grab your pen, and I want you to write the following down on a piece of paper. I want you to read it, and then I want you to send me a note after you read it. It's called yadaya.com. It's going to prove, without any doubt, that your belief system is wrong. And you're going to find it irrefutable if you read it. Then she says, you know, but I don't want a God that is so judgmental he condemns people to hell. Half of what you're looking for.
I'm with you there.
Yeah, I said half of what you're saying there is important. Almost all atheists and agnostics that are atheists and agnostics are so because they realize that the Christian position that God says, love me or I'm going to see that you're tortured forever in hell, would be a sadistic deity. And she said, yes. I said, well, I've got good news for you. Half good news here. The half good news is that 99.999% of souls simply cease to exist at the end of their mortal lives. They don't know God. God doesn't know them. No heaven, no hell. Very few people go to either heaven or hell. To end up in hell, you have to deliberately lead people away from God. However, if you're not judgmental, you can't be rational. So God is judgmental. I know that does not fit with political correctness, but the fact is God is judgmental. And if you're not judgmental, you can't be rational. You can't be moral. You can't be civil. You have to exercise good judgment to think. And I said, you see that word there, that yada word? It means to know. Let me show you what the Hebrew word is for to understand. And I wrote down bien, and I said, you know the difference between these two? No? Making connections. Understanding the relationships between things. Are you willing to go where the words lead? And she says, well, you know, I'm not interested in a God that wants to be worshipped. I think that is pathetic.
Oh, well, what? Step up to the plate, young lady.
Yeah, I said, my friend Larry would like that one. I said, well, you're in luck. God does not want to be worshipped. That would be an insecure God. A God that wants to be worshipped would not be a
It'd
God.
It'd be like Joe Stalin, you know.
Yeah, it would be a God
from Mao. Kowtow to Mao. He's afraid he'll lose power, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, we end up talking about all of the other issues that she had with God. I said, you know, your animosity to God happens to be
your animosity towards religion.
Tell me about this God. I said, well, he, and she says, how about she? Why he? I said, well, it's interesting you say she. God obviously doesn't have a sex because he's a spiritual being, but he presents himself as Father. That's a masculine term, but the masculine term is offset by the fact that he also presents himself as Mother. And, you know, he doesn't say that the Father is more important than the Mother. And so if you want to relate to God as she, you can have at it, because the Ruach, the spirit of Yahweh, is all maternal, and the and yet he plays the role of father of his family. So, if she is important to you, you're in luck. And in fact, there is nothing wrong with anybody who is listening to this program to relate to Yahweh as she, because Yahweh does manifest himself in our world more dramatically, more vividly, more actively as the set-apart spirit, as the Ruach Kodesh, than in any other way, and it's feminine. As are, by the way, almost every Hebrew word that's really important. For example, Bereth, covenant, it's feminine. Dabar, feminine. You know what's interesting about Yahweh's name? You know how you make a word feminine from masculine in Hebrew? For example, Ben is the word for son. You know how you make it feminine? It's Bena. You add the hey at the end of it. You know that Yahweh's name is feminine in Hebrew?
Never thought of that before.
I've always wondered why he did it, because, you know, the Greeks had a conniption fit because Yahusha is feminine in Greek, and that's why they changed the ending of his name, because you couldn't have a guy with a girl name. Now the Ain that is the end of Yahusha isn't feminine in Hebrew, but Yahweh is absolutely feminine.
Well, I mean, that makes total sense because, you know, one of the things that religion always does is tries to turn everything backwards. I mean, really, you know, and so, it, you know, that's why females are so trashed in religion. And they are. I mean, they are.
Yeah. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, it's kind of fun that because the hey in the middle of a word does not give the word feminine or masculine identity, but the hey at the end of the word does. So it actually adds some credence to my speculation that the two people standing in Yahweh's name are Abraham and Sarah, representing the covenant, and that Sarah would be the feminine ending of the feminine hay at the end of Yahweh's name.
Well, Yisrael is a feminine noun.
No. Yeah, by the way, Yisrael is a feminine noun in Hebrew as well. So, but to you know, to have that kind of a discussion about a God that doesn't want to be worshipped, a God that doesn't send most people to hell, and a God who can absolutely be known. So I said, so what are you going to do when you're confronted with absolute proof that the God who you do not think exists actually exists? When he proves his existence, are you going to consider what he has to say? And she said, I suppose I would have to. Yeah, I guess I would suppose I would have to. So that was kind of an interesting
day. This is a big day.
Yeah, it was kind of an interesting day today.
Yeah, it is. You got up on the right side of the bed there, and they just walked right into you, didn't they?
Yeah.
Three of them.
Yeah, I was also pleased today because I really wanted to talk about it because it's from my perspective, and again, I'm prejudiced here because, you know, I've devoted the time. You know, when I write a chapter for any one of these books, I mean, all I'm really doing is satisfying my own curiosity. And I don't write for anybody other than I want to learn. I'm curious. I'm trying to seek answers and understanding. And I just end up sharing what what I've written. So, you know, I do it really just because I enjoy this whole discovery thing. So, Kirk calls today, and Kirk wants to talk about the chapters he and his wife, Terry, read over these past few days, which are the two really long chapters. They're both in the 150, 160 page range, that have recently added to the seventh volume of Yada Yah. And my concern with these chapters is they're unlike anything I've ever offered to anybody before, because everything has been, here's what God said, let's analyze the words, and let's figure out what this means. Right? I mean, that, if you looked at every one of the books, that's all they ever do. They don't, you know, it's a real simple formula. What did Yahweh say? What does it mean? How is it, does it relate to other things? And then let's go on to the next thing he said. Well, in these two chapters, I wanted to understand what the problem with Rome. Why did God hate Rome so much? Because he hates Rome. And so I did one where there's over 100 pages that just detail the viciousness of Rome, but also expose...
Where have you added that, by the way, or have you yet?
Volume 7 of Yada Yah. So go to yadayah.com, volume 7, and the first chapter is the long history of Rome, because in Daniel 7...
In the last days?
No. Daniel 7 is the history of nations immediately after Daniel. You know, goes from Babylon to Persia, Persia to Greece, Greece to Rome. And,
yeah, that's right.
All right.
Yeah.
And so Yahweh says of Rome that it's vicious, that it's conniving, that it is deadly, that it is so much worse than Babylon and Persia and Greece that you can't even compare them. Now, I had no idea that Alexander the Great was an absolute ruthless, arrogant piece of crap. I mean, he was hideous. Anybody who would say that Alexander the Great was a great anything doesn't know the man. He was repulsive. And so when you consider how vicious Alexander was and Greece was, and then for God to say, you know, you read most of what you always have to say, he just despises Babylon, right? And he says that Rome is so much worse than Babylon, you can't even compare them. So I figured, I know, I had no idea that Rome was really that bad. I mean, I was indoctrinated in school, you know, and Rome was great. I mean, America has...
we're up there pledging allegiance to a Roman flag. I know.
Right. I mean, all of America's symbols are Roman.
Hand over the heart.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's the eagle.
The red, white, and blue. I'll have the red, white, and blue
eagle
mask
was,
and all that.
Yeah. In fact, the eagle, like the American eagle, was the symbol of Rome, was the symbol
was
of
the standard.
It's Aquila.
Oh, yeah.
Its Aquila eagle was the single most important aspect of ancient Rome in terms of their nature. And so here's...
When you say the seventh volume, though, I just want to get this straight. What do you...
There's seven volumes of Yada Yah.
The seventh volume of Yada Yah
has been offline for probably 3 years because when I did that major edit prior to editing Questioning Paul, I just took it off because there was in the seventh volume there was way too much. That was the only one where there was so much Paul in it. It wasn't worth saving. And the only thing that I wanted to keep in Volume 7 was the analysis of Yashaya Isaiah 17 and 18, because I thought it spoke of America. And now I realize, at the time I wrote it, I had no idea what was going to happen in Syria. It was long before the Syrian war. And I wanted to reposition it, but as just an independent chapter. And as it turned out, Isaiah 17 became a chapter, and Isaiah 18 became a chapter. When they became a chapter, Yoel came up with the new site for Yada Yah, and he put those two chapters in Volume 7. So now Volume 7 actually had two chapters. But those
are capsules. Volume 7 anywhere where I can read it?
Yeah. I mean, YadaYada.com.
Yeah, well, I'm there.
YadaYada.com. Look across the top. There are 7 volumes.
Well, there's Genesis. There's,
yes, volume 1.
Yeah, there's 7 volumes. The last volume is entitled Last Days.
There you go.
That's what
click
I asked.
It.
Yeah.
Click on it.
Okay.
Click on it.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So you'll have the 2 volumes on YadaYada.com.
Government Part 1. Oh,
yep.
Okay.
And then there's those 2, chapters 1 and chapter 2. They're so long that as it turned out, the new Microsoft and web interfaces for presentation online won't even allow you to have a chapter with that many characters. So we had to break them into part 1 and part 2. But in part 1, there is a history of Rome, but not a history of Rome in terms of wasn't Rome great. This is a very different history of Rome. This is a history of Rome exclusively by battles, every battle that Rome fought, who they fought, what their strategy was, how they treated the people, what the whole analysis of who were Rome's enemy, because Yahweh's condemnation of Rome was that they were vicious, that they were deadly, that they were more brutal than any other civilization in human history. Past, present, future. So I figured, well, if he's making that claim, I need to focus on the battles that Rome fought. And so I did a 120-page analysis of every battle, every single battle that Rome fought is chronicled there. And I took months to do this. I mean, I just satisfied my own curiosity. But when we reached the time of Ulios the Hairy One, Caesar means hairy in Latin, and Ulios was his name, Julius Caesar. Things changed. I mean, Rome was vicious. They were conniving. It was the Republic of Rome was really no better than the Empire of Rome, but the personalities changed. And in each of the personalities was modeled the beast. And then I realized the reason God took so much time to explain that the beast that is Rome not only is far more savage than any other beast, not only is it the worst of all human institutions throughout time, but what he's saying is that the personality of that beast is the same as the personality of the beast of the last days, the Taurus one. If you want to know the Taurus one, if you want to find out why God hates Rome, and when you realize that in Daniel 7, Yahweh makes it really clear that while Rome dies, Rome continues to trample the world. And it doesn't just trample a region. It's the entire world that Rome...
Well, that's what's going on today.
Right, trampled.
Sure, through all the banking systems that they run on, the World Bank, the UN, all
that.
Yeah,
it's pretty light on the bank. It's pretty heavy on the church. So, and it's not just the Roman Catholic Church, it's also the Eastern Orthodox Church. But
the church is the wealthiest organization in the world.
Yeah,
it's
not the wealthiest, but it is wealthy. It's no question wealthy. It's not the wealthiest.
Well, what's wealthier than the RCC? I mean...
Chinese, the Russians,
so.
I mean, enormous numbers of states. In fact, Bill Gates has a greater net worth than does the Roman Catholic Church. So...
Hmm.
Yeah, they're wealthy. The Vatican's bank isn't even a major player amongst world banks. I mean, it's not impoverished by any stretch of the imagination. But when you actually look at its accounts, about 6 months ago, I actually did an investigation of the Vatican's bank, and it's a bit player. It's not a major player. They're much smaller. Roman Catholicism took a major hit. And with exception of South America and Central America, where Roman Catholicism is blended with the Inca, the Mayan, and the Aztec religion, and therefore is really popular. Outside of Central and South America, Roman Catholicism has taken about a 40% hit in the last 20 to 30 years. Even in Hispanics in America, about 50% of Hispanics in America have distanced themselves and no longer aligned themselves with the Roman Catholic Church. So, yeah, it's taking it on the chin.
As much as that is, it should be much more.
Oh, of course, it should be even more, but it's just important to know the Roman Catholic Church is really taking it on the chin. And I really want to be clear here that while, and this is why the next chapter is so important, there are lots of Protestant Christian eschatologists are willing to condemn Rome, as in the Roman Catholic Church. And while the Roman Catholic Church is rotten to the core and is the living heart of the beast, it's important to recognize that the beast isn't the Roman Catholic Church. It's Christianity. It's the religion of Christianity in its entirety. The Roman Catholic Church just happens to be the head or the heart, depending on what you want to look at, of the beast.
The seat is the way you put it.
Yeah, the throne, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
It's the most important part of the beast. But those who would say the beast is the Roman Catholic Church, that it's the second Babylon, no. It's Christianity is what grew out of Rome. Rome went from empire to church. And it's not just
right.
The Roman Catholic
of course it
did. Church. It's all of Christianity.
Yeah, but it's also very, very, in my opinion, this is my opinion, but it's also very controlling. It has controlling interest when a pope
Protestant
dies.
Christianity. So does
Protestant
Christianity.
But they're just part of it.
I received a letter today from a listener to this program and to the Shattering Myths program. And he had a good friend who attends one of these swanky Presbyterian churches, one of the ones that I attended, as an elder in, where it was affluent people, all using the church to do an occasional good deed with the tax benefits. And the pastor, like the pastor when I was an elder in the Presbyterian church, had multiple PhDs, that kind of a church. And so he was talking about how he went about exposing the lies of the church and chipping away at the pastor. Said, no, we're going to stay on each subject. We're not going to move from a subject until you admit that you have deceived your congregation on this subject. And we're going to start with Jesus. And then we're going to go to Christ. And then we're going to go, in Revelation, it constantly says, if you're on the good side of Revelation, if you're on the bad side, that's why I began this the chat room by saying, here's the name of the beast. If you want to know what the name of the beast is, here's the name of the beast. Yahweh gave it to us. But what he also says, and he's very clear, that name is going to be on people's foreheads. But he also said that those who are not afflicted have the name Yahweh.
You think that's a literal mark, by the way?
Absolutely.
I don't.
Yeah, I do.
You do. Mm-hmm. I think it's what they're thinking about and what they're doing with their hands. But okay,
yeah.
You think it's
yeah.
A
he said mark on the head. God does have a sense of humor. You know the Hebrew letter for mark. It's the last letter in the Hebrew alphabet. It's the first letter in the Hebrew word Torah. The first letter in the word Torah means signature or mark. Mark of the beast,
yeah.
Right? The first letter, God says, here's the math. The math is 660 and 6. Okay.
That's right.
In Hebrew, there is no letter designation for 600. The last number designation is the Tau, which is 400. Okay? Tau means mark. To get to 600 in Hebrew, you have to add 400 and 200. Guess what the letter is for 200 in Hebrew? Head. Now he's constantly saying,
right.
if you think about this, you're going to understand it. He says the mark will be on the head. The first letter. When you do 600, 600 is mark head. It's tall.
You're right. Mark head. Yeah, I'm looking right at it here.
Yeah, it's Mark. It's Mark.
And then Thorne, you got a separate. You've just been there separated,
you go.
Buddy.
Okay, and now Thorne. What was the first thing that when Paul was saying that his God spoke to him? What did he say?
Yeah, thorn in his side.
He said it's going to be difficult for you to kick against the goad. The goad was a thorn. And then when Paul explains his source of inspiration, he says that the thorn, the goad, the thorn in my side is a messenger from Satan.
Right, he did.
He's talking about Pauline Christianity is the thorn.
Well, now, see, I've always thought this. I always thought it. See, when I say Catholic, RCC, I mean, that's kind of a catch-all to me because they invented it. You know, I mean, they're the people that made a universal
really interesting,
church.
And this is what was so fascinating to me, is that Catholicism was not invented in Rome. Rome, by the time of Catholicism, Rome was barely alive. Rome wasn't even the capital of the Western Roman Empire at the time that Catholic came into the nomenclature, before there became a Catholic Church. At the time of the Catholic Church was 60 years after Constantine. It was conceived in Constantinople in the East, and at the time, Rome was an afterthought. Rome wasn't even Milan was the capital of the Western Roman Empire at the time of Theodosius. Rome, the end of Rome as a seat of power really was during the time that Constantine was battling. When Constantine was having his fight for power, his civil war, Rome was still vital. But from that moment on, there was nothing meaningful about Rome. The Western Empire moved to Milan. So Catholic is an Eastern term. And so Roman Catholic didn't mean Rome and the city of Rome. It was that the Eastern Empire, before it, after the West completely fell, then after Theodosius, Rome, which was still, the Eastern Empire was still considered Roman at the time, and Christianity was imposed as the official religion, which means if you weren't a Catholic, and we'll speak of what Catholic meant here in a moment, and Roman Catholic, that you were killed. They did the same thing that the Islamic State is doing in Iraq today. And so the reason for Catholic, and so now you know Roman doesn't mean Rome as in the city of Rome. But
I never thought it did.
The empire of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Catholic, which means universal. But what happened was, at the time of Theodosius, they were still trying to resolve the Arian controversy. And the Arian controversy, it was Arius that St. Augustine despised. It was Arius that Constantine despised. Because Arius wouldn't allow the politicized Romans to create a new religion. Because Arius said that when you read what God said, you can't get to all of God residing bodily on a man. That Paul's statements about the man are inconsistent with what Yosha had to say. He is part a diminished manifestation of Yahweh, the God of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And so you can't create a religion of Christianity unless you can get rid of Arius. But Arius was really popular. And so Constantine, at the Council of Nicaea, began the crusade against Arius, where he was labeled a heretic. And then the politicized Christians began to attack them. And then by the time of Theodosius, it was the last battle between the two, and all Arians were killed. And at that point, Catholic was the term for non-Arian, for the Dionysus religion of Christianity was the term Catholic. Arian was the term for individuals that would not separate God the Father and God the Son, saying that one is separate.
Well, I want to throw this in, too. Marcion was probably a Gnostic, I'm guessing.
Correct.
And, you know, he's the guy that put Paul's letters in a nice little book.
Right.
But he was also the son of a bishop, okay?
Right.
And a bishop of what?
Yeah, of...
You know,
at
so
that,
there
at
we
that
go.
Point, though, I mean, there wasn't,
that's
there wasn't
back
a Catholic
in 144
church at that point.
CE or
yeah.
something.
Yeah, at that point there wasn't a Catholic church, but you're dealing at that time.
But there was a hierarchy
right.
somewhere
yeah.
in order for him
See,
to have been a
what
son
happened
of a bitch.
Also with the Rome, and it's really interesting to understand how Christianity could have emerged completely disconnected from its roots, with its roots severed and planted in a revisionist context. And so by analyzing Rome, you get to see how that was possible because of the culture that was created in Rome. And the single most important player in all of this isn't Theodosius, and it isn't Constantine. It's Hadrian. And Hadrian is the one that renamed everything and went to war with the Torah, making the Torah illegal, burned it. In fact, what he would do is he would take a Hebrew scholar, and he would every copy of the Torah, everything written in Hebrew, he would wrap it around the Hebrew scholars and soak the Torah in water first and then burn them alive to let the Torah slow down the death to make it more agonizing. And he stood...
Well, this guy, Hadrian, was just lovely.
Oh, he was lovely. Yeah, he was lovely. He made punishable by death to celebrate, observe the Shabbat, or any one of Yahweh's dates. He was the one that changed the calendar, and he's the one that outlawed circumcision, said if you're circumcised, the mark of death.
So literally, if you participate in the covenant, you're dead.
That's correct.
That's a pretty tough choice. I'd pick the circumcision still.
And then he renamed Jerusalem after himself. And then he was the one that built the temples of Zeus and Jupiter and temple to himself there on the Temple Mount. And he killed millions of Jews, millions, and then salted the land and then renamed the land, which was Yehudah. He renamed it Philistina. So that's Hadrian. Hadrian created the climate where it was possible for where Pauline Christianity, which was at war with its own roots, could take root. And if it wasn't for Hadrian, Pauline Christianity would never have taken root. But what I was going to say is that if you study the emperors of Rome, from Caesar on, Julius Caesar was the consummate warrior politician. He would have been the Eisenhower, if you will, of our time. And then you go to Octavian and his persona, and then him establishing himself as deity, and then his establishment of the censor to have Rome begin to promote political correctness. This whole path, and then how you get from there Claudius and how each of these personalities, and then a guy like Caligula, and then Nero.
You're talking about animals. They're absolute animals. Yeah.
They're absolute animals. And they are, and when you study their own strategies and their politics, I've always assumed that you could predict how the Torahless one's going to forgive debts. Then he is going to confiscate savings. Then he's going to go to war with the elitists and the bankers and the industrialists and everybody that swept him into power. He's going to turn on them. Yeah, he's going to turn on them.
Absolutely.
And so when I was reading about Nero and even Caligula and the economic policies that they promoted, they're exactly that. You can study Nero and Caligula and Claudius, for example, and Hadrian, and know exactly what the Torahless one's going to be like in terms of his personality, and you can know exactly what he's going to do in terms of his strategy. Yeah, it's all right? And I was just amazed as that if you look at the beast, particularly at this time, and you compare that to what you know about Paul and what you know about Christianity, and you know what the Torahless one is going to do, and you tie it all together through that history, you can see every single move that's going to happen over the next 20 years.
Well, I've got a lot to read there. I'm going to read it all. I never even realized. Well, and why isn't 3 and 4? I've got a chapter 1, 2, 3, 1 and 2.
1 and 2. And then
5 and 6.
5 and 6.
But
so
I don't have
3 and 4 is not there.
Four.
And 3 and 4 is not there because 3 is Daniel 9. Now, for those who have read Yada Yada, you know that I've already done a chapter on most, but not all, of Daniel 9. That's the timeline to the Maaseiah. But following Daniel 7 and Daniel 8, and by the way, there's a whole story in there about Greece too. And then in the second chapter, there's a probably 75 to 100 pages devoted to Greece and Rome, and how Greece and Rome made Christianity possible. In terms of historical analysis and a perspective on history that causes you to understand the Christian mindset and how Christianity became possible, it's really an interesting read. But Daniel 9 follows. And so I'm now about a quarter of the way through a chapter of Daniel 9. That'll be 3. And then you still have to deal with Daniel 10 and 11 because they also frame history, and that's what's going to follow. And then you have those end chapters. But then, you know, there's still, and I don't know how many chapters I have to put in between, because you've got to do a chapter on Yashaya 17, not 17, but on 14, which introduces Satan and the Babylonian connection. And, you know,
This is just going to grow because I know you. So,
I've just reread all of Ezekiel, now I have to put in what Ezekiel had to say. And then there is much more in Daniel about the nature of the Torahless one. It's a growing concern. I was very happy today that Kirk had read it with Terry and that they wanted to discuss it. And, it's unlike anything that I've ever written before, so, you know, I'm open to constructive criticism, like, it's too long, there's too much, you know, it's not uplifting.
Yeah, but you won't change that, so it doesn't matter anyway. Just throw it in there. Yeah.
All right. Well, it's all there right now.
Okay. Well, I've got a lot to read here. I can see that. I don't know why I didn't.
Well, the two really long chapters have just been added within the last few weeks. And the second one there just got added in the last week because I've just now finished it. So anyway, it is a lot to consider. And as I was reading Revelation, because before I go too much further, I'm trying to read. In fact, I've now done it. I've read every prophetic book that deals with the last days, and so that I have a word's eye view of the whole thing before we, you know, write a whole lot.
Are there any of them that are even worth considering? I mean, I've seen some of these that are so far off.
In terms of making connections to
in terms of reality. I mean, really.
One of the challenges is that as you read Revelation, it appears to me that a very substantial purpose for Revelation was Yahusha saying, yeah, I understand that some of the predictions that I sealed up, that I said wouldn't be understood to the last days of Daniel, were pretty hard to understand. So I think that to a large degree, right around 12 to the end, that lots of Revelation exists to help us understand Daniel. It's a lot of things that are interesting. I would tell you that if you wanted to say, if I had a single thought that I could share with you about the blend of the totality of all of the prophets, because I've just completed reading all of the prophets. And if I were to say there was a single thought, the single thought would be that Yahweh has constantly asked us to listen to him, to observe the terms and conditions of his Torah, of his covenant, to study his Torah, and to pay attention to the means that he has to resolve disputes, and to make an about face as humankind, and to come to know him. And at the same time, he's saying, if you do that, all is forgiven. I mean, the moment you do that, you're part of my family, all is forgiven. And at the same time, he's saying that...
You're part of my family, all is forgiven. And at the same time...
What he's saying is that there is literally nothing, almost no one, and sometimes no one, that he can find... that he can work with, because his people are so abysmal, that they are so lost, that they're so into religion and politics and militarism and their infidelity, that it just screams from these pages that Yahweh says, I, there's nothing I can do with you. I want to help, but I can't help, because I only work through people, and there's not a single soul that I can work through.
Well, I mean, we go right back to Bereshit, and I mean, I've been reading a lot of that, and, you know, you have to walk to him of your own volition, of your own accord, and that's the big thing, isn't it? That's why everybody wonders, you know, I go to tell family members, they won't listen, I go to tell my own kids, they don't want to hear it, and that's because everybody that walks to Yahweh has to do it of their own volition.
Yeah, I think until we get to the last 3.5 years of the tribulation, until we get to that period, I think that Yah's math, which is 1 in a million, that the 1 in a million, which he says, you know, thousands amongst billions, which is 1 in a million, I embrace him by observing the terms and conditions of the covenant, that I think that math is true all the way until the last few years or year of the tribulation.
Then it gets better than that.
Yes.
Don't you?
Yeah. By a factor of probably 100. That there
that's a huge
than being 7,000, you're dealing with either 10 to 20 times that amount, and maybe even more.
Well, that's huge. That's very huge.
But you see, the difference is that during the last 3 years, the conditions are so hellish. The times are so desperate, and the choice is so clear. You know, if you choose the beast, it's over. There's no forgiveness. There's no turning back. It's constant torment. And if you choose the beast, then you can't die. You'll want to die, but you can't die ever.
Yeah, I know. I saw that too. Whoa.
Yeah. So you're in a very different. A construct. There's no other period in all of time that is like this. And God's saying, you know, we're going to end time at this point, and the last 3.5 years is going to be unlike any other period. And you either choose the beast or you choose me. If you choose me, it's going to be a hellish period you're going to live through, but you're going to live forever. And if you choose me, you literally will have Yahweh's name written on your forehead. Absolutely written there. It's written there by one of his malach.
Well, I could stand that.
Oh.
You know, I got to tell you, you know, I know that that's why that horrible part of the tribulation is there as
force
a separation point.
Yes, it's to force the decision, because he's going to come back, and he can't come back with people saying, well, wait a minute, I didn't get my chance to choose. There's one point where he comes back in the midst of lives. There'll be, you know, there'll be some remnant of the 7 billion people, less than half of them left. Somewhere less than 3.5 billion people, but they'll be in the midst of their lives. And so it would be unfair for God and uncharacteristic for God to force a decision on them. So what he does is he creates a construct where everyone chooses. And so when he returns, everyone will have made a choice. They'll either have Yahweh's name written on their foreheads, or they're going to have the mark on the head of the thorn securely there, which would be the tent peg. So the thorn is going to be securely on the marked on the head is really what it means.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty profound there.
Yeah, will be securely marked on the head. That's so at that point, it's different than any other time. And Yahweh, he has unleashed all of this menacing stuff towards the end of the tribulation. He actually says, you know, I'm going to bring this to a head. And so it's a time where particularly Yisraelites and Yehudim are going to have listened to the two witnesses. And the two witnesses are going to be extraordinarily effective communicators. Most people are going to hate them. And life on Earth is going to be miserable. We're going to have major climate change, both sun and weather. And people are just going to hate them, and it's going to be agony here. And so there will be a period of time where a disproportionate number of people, based on history past, will choose to trust the message of those two messengers speaking on behalf of Yahweh. So that's the story. Okay. That being the case, I think we have Diane's listening. Diane had a question, and Steve is also listening, and Steve had a question. So I'm not sure I'm going to be able to answer either of them, but I'm absolutely willing to try. Why don't we go first with Diane, since she's held the longest. Hello, Diane.
Hello, Yada. How are you doing?
Good. Yeah, it's been a fun day today.
My question, it sounds like you had a really great day.
Yes.
So my question is, I've been trying to research who the Daughters of Zion are.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of sounded interesting when you were talking about how it turns feminine, you use the hay on the back of a word. But,
right.
And I don't see that. But I just found it striking, especially when that was my question before you made that statement. However, has anybody come to a conclusion who the daughters
are? Yeah, you know, I because it's in the prophets, I read that just in the last 2 days. I came across the Daughters of Zion, and there's several comments right there that speak of daughters. And what's interesting is there's two references to daughters, and one is hideously bad. You know, one is they've been like Muslim mothers, you know, reared their children to hate and to die. And then there's one that is the Daughters of Zion. And quite frankly, what I've done is I went through all of these, you know, the broad swath, and I marked the things where I said, you know, I really need in context to translate this, because I was just reading it superficially. And that's one of the things I went back and said, I need to dig into this. And you know, all I know for certain that I can tell you at this point is two things. Is that one is there's going to be as many men as there are women that will enter the covenant. The covenant is doesn't discriminate between men and women. We have different roles as mother and father. But it is for both sons and daughters. So you would expect Yahweh to reach out and include daughters. Now, Zion is. I was surprised, and this word I view that I did, you know, the 30,000 foot review, how often Zion is mentioned. You know, you, I always thought, you know, Mariah is the thing, you know, and Mariah this, Mariah that. But, you know, after you leave Abraham on Mount Moriah, and then you, you move to Yosha on Mount Moriah, there isn't much mention of Mount Moriah.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is Zion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in Yahweh, throughout the prophets, I mean, he's just constantly talking about the importance of Zion and having an affinity for Zion and his love for Zion and how Zion is the center from his point of view of Jerusalem. And he's and so the, you know, the definition of Zion, which means signs or signposts or signs posted on the way, illuminating, because Own would also speak of that which is eternal and illuminated, but that which illuminates our eternity regarding the path to Yahweh. That's that from God's point of view, that Zion is where he is making his eternal declaration known to humankind. You know, the witnesses, they're gonna make certain that the working with the Malach, that Yahweh's, the tablets that he etched in stone, they're gonna be held up over Zion. You know, and he is absolutely fixated on the importance of the signs that he has put on the way, and that is Zion. So if you're just by definition, if you're a daughter of Zion, then you are a woman who, as a member of the covenant family, have focused on the signs that Yahweh has placed on the way to him. So it would be somebody, in a woman in particular, who has a great affinity for the seven Moed Mikre, which are the steps along the way, and his Torah testimony explaining these steps along the way. So by literal definition, that's what a daughter of Zion would be.
You know what comes across my thinking, and that is Dinah. And she wanted Dinah. When,
yeah.
And I don't know how those stories, it's just coming across my mind that maybe Dinah is in that deal. But, so how far is Hebron from Mount Zion, would you say that is? Because Hebron used to be the original capital of Judea.
Right.
And then they switched it over to Jerusalem, and
I think Hebron, like, 20 miles, something of that nature. I mean, not very far.
Was that the vicinity of Zion?
It's not very far, but it was Dode, of course, who moved the capital to Jerusalem. And the other thing that, you know, since you mentioned this, and Larry said, okay, so, you know, what were the overriding themes? You know, what was really important? And the thing that struck me the most, if you read all the prophetic books at once, is the sadness of God not finding anybody that he could work with to communicate his testimony. In other words, nobody for hundreds upon hundreds of years. And how frustrating.
Yeah, Yahweh must be wondering if he gave us the correct brain structure.
Absolutely.
That is a serious problem.
Oh, it's a serious problem.
You know, I really thought about that for 400 years, not to be able to have anybody listen to him. I mean, nobody.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that I was going to say that really struck through this is I'll bet that between the prophets that there isn't a single prophet where Yahweh doesn't say multiple things about the importance of Dode, and that it's the city of Dode, that it's the kingdom of Dode, that it's for the love of Dode. In fact, there's one place that I was just tickled pink that he was talking about. It was obvious that God was referring to the 119th Psalm on Dode's understanding of the Torah teaching. So Dode is hugely important. You know, there was somebody didn't like me very much and was on one of the various sites and accused me of a religion of Doe because I was so into Doe's lyrics and interpretation of the Torah and how to observe the Torah. And while I don't like the to be accused of being religious, if we do not gain an appreciation for how important this one individual is to Yahweh, I mean, he will occasionally associate the Torah with Moshe. He will occasionally mention Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob. But there's only one person that throughout the prophets is Yahweh's model, his love, he's saying, you know, if you want to be on the inside, if you want to be adored and loved and right and understand, it's all about Dode. So there
yeah, right. I happen to have seen that comment, the new religion of Dode.
Yeah.
You know, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I mean, who you are the first one to say, you know, what religion was Dode? And the answer is none.
None.
That's
but,
right.
But there's no way that God would take an individual, when, you know, he is the King of Kings, when creator of the universe, and he's saying that he's going to live and enable the kingdom of Dode during the 1,000-year celebration of the Sukkah and of Shabbat, and how essential his love for Dode is, and how important Dode's perspective is, that if we don't view his writings from the perspective that Dode provided, we're cheating ourselves.
There's one human being who ever lived whose example I don't mind being accused of following. It would be Dode.
Yes, right. Yeah, and it's not from behavior, it's from attitude.
Yeah.
What's your focus? Dode's focus was the Torah. What's most important to you? Developing a better knowledge and understanding of the things that are important to Yahweh and capitalizing upon them. That was the entire mindset of this man. And so if you want to follow a man's attitude and approach to God, that's the guy.
Yahweh's whole Torah was about his beneficial instructions, his judicial statutes, and judgments.
Yeah.
And I believe that Dode, and he said in the 119th Psalms, I mean, that's what Dode loved most about
right.
Yahweh was that.
Right.
And that's why Yahweh loved Dode so much. And there is
right.
so much relationship with Yahweh in just that, because he is about beneficial instruction, judgment, and judicial statutes. And that's the
right.
realm I believe that
yeah.
he functions in. He don't, like,
right.
you know, we talk about sometimes, you know, oh, I need a new car or whatever, but he don't function in that realm. He functions in the realm.
Dode never functioned in that realm.
Statutes.
Yeah,
yeah.
Dode was never into, boy, we really like to win the lottery, and that would make my life, you know, I'll give you 10%. Dode was never in that. Dode didn't say, you know, if I could win this next round in the big contest, I'd be really appreciative. I'll give you credit, you know. Well, I'll put up my finger and point to the heavens. Dode was never into that. Dode's entire approach is, I want to focus on what's important to Yahweh. And he figured out that the best way to please God was to observe, was to care about, was to think about, was to celebrate, was to write about the things that were important to God. And so long as he was spending his time doing that, the more he would do it, the more God came to love him. And it's an example, as James, you said, it's an example for all of us. If we want to earn, by earn, I don't mean, you know, you're doing a deed, but if you want to position yourself in the same position with the same amount of love that Yahweh has for Dode, do as Dode did.
You know, I want to throw one thing in here. One of the things Dode, as Diane just kind of pointed out, it's and you pointed out several times, is it wasn't Doe's behavior. It was never Doe's behavior. And, and you know, if you look at Doe's behavior from a religious perspective, you go, oh, he stood against an army and he stood there and I want to be like Doe. But Doe realized there was all kinds of other baggage he carried, too.
Yeah. Actually, Doe didn't
and it
stand
seems
against
like
an
nobody
army.
Else
all,
does.
All Doe did is stand against one man.
Yeah, well, sure.
Right?
But he stood in front of a whole army. I mean, he did, that was pretty tough. But people think he stood against a giant.
No, the biggest, baddest warrior they had. But
but I have to say that's the perspective people try to take away from it. They're not taking away the perspective that he has, which is
when Yahweh says, "Here's the math of the name of the beast, and the first is letter is mark for the mark of the beast, and the other is head, mark on the head, and the next one is thorn, as in Pauline Christianity." I think that Dode is very much like Moshe. Moshe was chosen to introduce us to God's name and to God's word, and God picked the least likely candidate in the world at that time, which was a stutterer, to articulate God's word and God's name. I mean, it's just perfect Yahweh. She says, okay, I'm going to show you that I want to work through people, but that I don't need a great person. I just need somebody whose attitude is right. I want to work through a stutterer. Then God says, all right, I need to choose to work through somebody that will exemplify what I most desire. And he picked the guy whose behavior was absolutely disgusting. And so he's saying, I'm not looking for religious behavior here. I'm not looking for anything other than what's your priority? What's important to you? And if the thing that's most important to you is knowing and understanding Yahweh's words, then you will know how to please God, how to put yourself in a position where He loves you as much as He loves God. I just think it's so beautiful that you take a person whose behavior was highly flawed and you said, this is the example. So what do you need to do? Focus on the Torah. Did Dode have prophets available to him at the time?
No.
He had the Torah. He had Yahusha. He had the Judges, and he had his own Psalms. That was it. He figured it all out from there. I've come to the conclusion that the purpose of the prophets was to help us understand what Yahweh had said, and that the prophets exist for Yahweh to constantly remind us that we are universally being religious and political and militaristic, and by doing those things we are estranging ourselves and our children from Him, and He's begging us to stop, so that we will listen to Him instead. He's just constantly saying, read the Torah, read the Torah, read the Torah. And what did Dode do? Read the Torah.
Exactly that. But, I mean, see, again, you know, we could point out that he collected all the product that was needed to build the temple. He did a lot of great things, you know, somebody would see it from a religious standpoint. But what he really did was had a relationship with Yahweh because he made those connections and understood the Torah.
Yeah.
And that's where
the
it's
thing
really
about Dode
at.
That is so interesting, too. If you read his Psalm,
you know,
Dode is never saying, this is Yahweh's words through me to you. You need to pay attention to this. That wasn't Dode's style. Dode's style was instead to think about what Yahweh had written, and to allow the Yahweh to enlighten and inspire him based upon the testimony, and then to write lyrics to songs that he himself sung that share those insights. And Dode was doing it for Dode. But it was memorialized for us. So, the pastor, the priest, gets up and is speaking to the audience based upon what they think or what they know. That's not Dode's style here. Dode's not preaching at us. He's not singing at us. Dode is studying Yah's testimony, enjoying the process, and then responding to Yahweh, and he just wrote it down so that we could experience his relationship with Yahweh. So we would have a window into this remarkable individual's relationship with Yahweh and understanding of Yahweh. So I think when we read the 119th Psalm, it's like we're being brought right into their conversation. Stephen, I understand that you have a question, too. Thank you for being patient, Steve.
I've been very patient.
Yes, you have.
Actually, my question was, speaking of the end times,
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what I want to get your opinion on is future history, mm-hmm. the writings of future history. Do you think that's legitimate?
Well, the Yahdiyah, it began with the Azab chapter, actually analyzing Isaiah, Yahshayah 17 and 18, because my closest friend at the time is the author of Future History. In fact, he doesn't even call it Future History anymore. He's changed the name of it. And he gave me that material, and he asked me to edit it for him, to think about it, study it, and get back to him on what I thought what he could do to improve it. And so I ended up completely rewriting it because he was using the New King James Version for his text. And what I found is that the New King James Version was so errant in its translation that he was coming to conclusions that weren't accurate. And then the second issue was that he was viewing all of it from a perspective of Pauline Christian eschatology. And so it was, the issues that were being discussed were from a Christian perspective. And so I gave him back my rewrite based upon what I had learned, and he was not fond of them. And so I said, maybe this is an opportunity. So what I would do is that I just kept on going. And when I kept on going, that became Yahdiyah. And the first volume happened to be the Azab volume, and then I went back later and did Haya and made that the first volume of the book. So this is what I would say, that there are lots of accurate and profound insights in what was called future history, but it is so ravaged by Pauline Christianity that it is a mixed bag, and I couldn't get the author, who is a very lovely man, to recognize that Paul was a false apostle, and that Christianity is a false religion. And so, I at one time I hosted his book. They were hosted on my site, and I provided.
So he actually works on the other team, by the way. I mean,
yeah. Provided probably 99.999% of the readership of his materials came from my various sites, the links that I provided to him. I have subsequently disassociated from it because I've had way too many people say to me, you're like secular Jews. They'll say, I've read your material and you're way too Christian. I said, wait a minute, I'm not Christian at all. And they said, but yeah, you are. And they'll start quoting, and it's always future history. And I said, I didn't write that. But I said, why put your link to it? So, you're supporting it. I said, no.
Time to take it off the site. Yeah,
so I finally took it off the site. Actually, I didn't take it off the site. It came off the site because of the fact that the all of the sites were taken down by Muslim denial of service attacks, and we couldn't bring the sites back up because the software was too old, and so we just simply didn't rewrite the software for those books. So they fell off.
My question, a lot of maybe was the timelines of what Future History, you know, claims as far as what the Bible says.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that's legitimate.
There is
there
is some accuracy in the sense of, and I don't know who figured this out or how we developed it, but we came to a conclusion that the prophecy in Daniel 9 points to 4 days before Passover in 33 CE, and that had to be year 4000 Yah. And we went through the math of that together, and then we recognized that the next three Moed Mikre that had to be fulfilled were Teruah, and then Yom Kippurim, and then Sukkah, and that it was collectively, it was obvious to us during the time we were studying together that Sukkah and Yom Kippurim before it had to be fulfilled 40 Yobel, or 2,000 years from 33 CE, which is when the first four Moed Mikre were fulfilled in year 4000 Yah. So if you want to know, is the timeline that Yahweh is going to return on Yom Kippurim, which is Monday at sundown, 6:22 p.m., October 2nd, 2033. That is, you can take that to the bank. That's when he's going to return.
Right.
And the millennial Shabbat is going to start 5 days later on a Friday evening. I would tell you that the likelihood of those dates being true is in the 99 percentile. And the reason that I will have a slight caveat is that while I think the Daniel prophecies are pretty clear in terms of what calendar to use, the 360 versus the 365, and as I've looked at the evidence for year 33, it is pretty overwhelming. And while the timing of Daniel 9 puts Yosha as the Passover lamb entering into Jerusalem 4 days before Passover, as he had to in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE. And 33 CE is the only year within 4 years, one way or the other, whereby the days of the week, as they are chronicled in by Matan Yah and Yah O'Connan, of Passover being celebrated on a Thursday evening, it continues to be Passover on Friday, and therefore that's the time that the Passover lamb is slain. Matzah is the most important day. It is a Shabbaton for it to fall on a natural Shabbat where his soul would go into Sheol. And then the first day of the week, which would be Bukhurim, or firstborn children, occurring. All of that timeline only works for 33 CE. And so if 33 CE is in fact the year 4000 Yah, which everything seems to indicate it is, and it's the only year within 4 years either way where the days of the week fall with the natural Shabbats and where they have to coincide with the eyewitness accounts, then 40 Yobel, and it's definitely 40 Yobel from that time, is 33 CE, and so the only possibility is that you know, we had a change from Julian to Gregorian calendars, and there's a lot of the Romans, which were the primary historians of the world, from 100 CE through about 400 CE, nothing any Roman historian wrote can be trusted. They were wholly revisionist. Disgusting in terms of their falsification of history. So those are some of the issues that are challenging to get through. But
okay.
That timeline, I'd give you a 99.9% likelihood of that. What do you guys think?
Well, I
look at
maybe,
a pop as an example.
Time,
I think that's
timeline.
Yeah.
Maybe timeline wasn't the proper word to use, but just the legitimacy of all the conclusions about, say.
Well, his chapter on the rapture, which is the one that I had to edit. That was the first one he gave me. The chapter on the rapture is not valid.
Oh, well, yeah.
There is no rapture. There's a Teruah harvest, but the Teruah harvest is specifically timed by Yahweh. It occurs
right.
immediately after the thinning of Yisrael and immediately before the Magog War. And so it's specifically timed, and it's all based on Yahweh's Torah, prophets, and Psalms presentation of Teruah, and future history is based on the Pauline analysis of Thessalonians.
Yeah, so basically I think that really I can delete that because,
I'm going to tell you, there's some smart stuff in there. He was pretty darn good in terms of working the days of Revelation. Not only Revelation, but Yahweh several places gives us a specific timeline for these last 3.5 years.
Uh-huh.
And he was, I think, quite accurate in his depiction of that period of time. If you could remove all of the Paul and Christian references, I think most of it is pretty decent.
Well, yeah. And
well, I mean, you know, he did some of the work on Apophis, didn't he?
Right.
And anybody who has studied and knows what you've revealed lately in the past several years and knows the Torah will be easily edit Paul out of future history.
Yes. Yeah,
and
true.
Be able to.
Yeah, I mean, I can read I can read the New American Standard Bible, and based on what I know about Yahweh, I can edit their erroneous terms out, and I can read it as it was written, as opposed to, so what you're saying is you do the same thing. Once you come to know that Paul was a fraud, and you come to understand Yahweh and his Torah, it's pretty easy to take something like that and edit the wrong out of it. I do it all the time. In fact, I would say translating is that way, because the tools that we use to translate, Steve, I like Strong's, for example, as one of the Hebrew dictionaries.
Yeah.
There's as much in it that's wrong as there is right. I mean, it's about 50-50 wrong and right. But once you know the truth, it's pretty easy to filter out the wrong and to see the right. But you have to grow with Yahweh and come to know him and gain his perspective. Once you have his perspective, then it becomes much easier.
Yeah, you just use the Torah as a mirror.
Correct.
Does this reflect right? No, it doesn't. Well, then it's not right. Reject it.
Right.
Or it's
the lens. You know, my lens that gives me insights and perspective, and my microscope, if you will, both a telescope and a microscope, is the Torah. I have found that if I accept and embrace Yahweh's perspective, if my understanding is as consistent as possible with his, that I'm going to be right all of the time, except those times where I have not done a very good job of aligning my perspective and understanding with his. But the closer I can get my perspective and understanding to be consistent with his Torah, to that degree, then we're going to be right in understanding the connection between things. And so, Steve, it's the reason why I've gone from being paranoid, for example, but really uncomfortable with doing the daily radio show to now being comfortable with it, because once you understand Yahweh's attitude, his perspective, his purpose, his offer, his instruction. And so long as you align your perspective with that, there really aren't a lot of things that somebody can say that are going to lead you to say, you know, I don't have a clue. You know, I don't know how to answer that one. Because,
well, you know what? That's the way I felt here, what, 6 years ago or whatever, when I first come across Yada Yah, was I was really uncomfortable, very uncomfortable, because of some of the New Testament scripture says in the last days there will be, you know, false prophets will come and all that, you know,
right.
And people will have itching ears and all that. And I was really uncomfortable with it. But, you know, the more you peruse the evidence and
right.
and put it up with what the Torah says, the more comfortable you become.
Yeah.
And it,
yeah,
took me,
and
it is.
And
it
I can see how
years.
Somebody, you know, just coming on Yada Yah would say, well, this guy that is writing this is pretending to be a prophet, and therefore we should be careful. Well, you always should be careful. I never claimed to be a prophet.
Right.
So I can't be a false prophet because I don't claim to be a prophet.
You're saying these are Yahweh's words, not mine,
yeah,
buddy.
I'm saying to the greatest extent, and I know I'm really open at the beginning of those books. I said, you know, I don't have any credential that's going to impress anybody. I'm as qualified to do this as Moshe was to pronounce Yahweh's name, and he was a stutterer. I was as qualified to tell you how to observe the Torah as Dode was, and he was a flawed dude. So, you know, I began by telling you, I don't have any qualifications. All I'm telling you is that I'm going to do the best I can to look at the oldest possible manuscripts and to give you as complete and accurate a description of what each word means. And then I'm going to give you that word and tell you, here's the tools that you can use to look up that word for yourself so you can do your own verification. And then I'm going to share with you the thought process that I went through to understand what the full implication was of everything that he said. And so all I'm saying is that Yahweh is a prophet. And that he proved that he authored the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And so now that I know for certain that he exists because he proved his existence, he proved his authorship through prophecy, I figured that what he has to say is important. I want to know what he has to say, and I figured I might as well share it because my guess is there's other people that want to know what he has to say. But under that basis, I can't be a false prophet because I'm not a prophet.
Can't be what you ain't claim to be.
Can't be what you don't claim to be. You will never see me write, you know, God said this, but I say. I ain't going there.
But I cringe, say.
Yeah, I did not go there. You know,
right,
but beyond that, we're being funny, but I want to tell you that I came through this process to really enjoy Yahweh's perspective, his style, his approach, his attitude, and the things that I was really the most uncomfortable with when I started this. And what I was uncomfortable with is, all right, I came to understand that Passover is the doorway to life. I came to understand that matzah is the threshold for that we're cleansed before we enter God's home. I came to understand that Bukkudim is the adoption process into Yahweh's family. I came to understand that Shavua means to enrich and empower God's children, and that how these are steps into his home where we enter the opportunity to camp out with the Mitzvah. Okay, so that's just one example, and I was saying, all right, this is really cool, the way that this all works. Why didn't God just explain it to us that directly? And so my first frustration was, why is it that I'm having to make these connections and to look at this broad swath of material and bring it all together to understand? Why didn't God just say it that succinctly? And then I finally realized that's not his style, and it's not his style because if it was his style, there would be no purpose for us to even exist, because at that point, we just become dumb animals that he stamps with, you know, here's the formula, here's the answer. Repeat after me. I became to realize that the entire thing is set up to be this grand voyage of discovery, of this of learning and understanding as a process, because that's got to be the filtering mechanism to decide who really wants to be with Yahweh, who enjoys his style, and that's what we're going to be doing for all eternity in heaven. And so if you don't enjoy that, then you're going to be a real, you know, lead balloon in heaven. So,
you know, but really, Yada, I think he did lay it out that simply because it's right there.
And Steve, that's where I finally came to is that, God, he really is that simple. He really is that direct. He's repetitive. He's clear. He's a master communicator. It's there in front of us, and if we just take the time to think about it, all the answers are right there.
Well, we were beguiled by Paul. So.
Yeah, it's true. We had a rotten.
Well, we were beguiled by a lot of things. I mean, you've got the whole. We were going over this tonight. The whole Roman thing where you're going in and talking to a flag. Didn't you think that was a great thing for years of your life? I did.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot, too, walking out of Babylon.
I was one of these flag-waving, God bless America and all that.
Yeah, me too.
Jeez. Good God, what a mistake. Yeah.
You know, Stephen, we need to go, and I'm going to leave you with this one thought, is that while it did take a lot of studying, a lot of thinking, a lot of connections to put the pieces together. Once you see who Yahweh is and what he's offering, the end result is so simple, it almost makes you say, why doesn't everybody see this? I mean, it all comes down to Yahweh wanting to enjoy a family for the same reason that as a father, I enjoy my relationship with my sons and my wife, and my favorite thing in life is to go off and do things with my wife and my sons. And Yahweh wants to be a dad. And because one of the things about being a dad or a mom is that you get to pour your life into your children. You get to lift them up. You get to teach them. You get to liberate them. You get to help them grow. And it's the most rewarding, the most enjoyable thing in the world. Yahweh wants that. He wants to be dad, and he wants children who want to spend time with him. And everything in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms all boils down to that.
Hey, but it's worse than what you just said. I mean, you know, it's not... And I know you got to go, but I just want to say this. Had somebody came up to me, say, 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and laid this in front of my face, I would have been thrilled. Okay? And it's easy to accept. It's all easy to verify. I mean, it all fits like a perfect puzzle. Most people fight against what you put in front of their face. Forget making the connections. You can make the connections for them.
Right. Are you willing?
you see what I'm saying?
I told this girl today when she came up, same thing I told the young man, is that the most liberating and empowering thing that you can do, if you're religious or you're an atheist, are you willing to say, I was wrong? And are you willing to go where the words lead? It's so empowering. It's so liberating to be able to admit that you're wrong and that you were misled, and then embrace truth.
Militant atheism is a religion too. So
of course,
you know,
that's what I hear.
You know, I think about what Yah must feel, being there billions that are on the planet, and mm-hmm. he only has a relationship with a few. I don't know. That must be rough on Yah.
Oh, yeah, and can you imagine there was a period of time, Steve, where he couldn't find anyone? He just says there was none.
You know,
I wanted to relate to my children, and there was no one.
I was wondering about that 400 years. I'm wondering if that wasn't just a pause, so he would say, I'm saying nothing else here. You listen to what I said to Dode, or what I revealed through Dode, and I'm saying nothing else for 400 years. Nothing else to say.
Yeah. Well, it's clear that nothing else needs to be said,
exactly.
But that's not Yahweh's style. He is constantly pointing us to him and away from that which is harmful.
Well, it must have been a bleak period then. Well, same as today, you know.
But
I think the louder voice is Islam today.
Yeah, it is, of course.
Yeah,
it is. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, I got to run, guys, but it was fun. We didn't get to the 119th Psalm, but sometimes just there are other
perspectives. Hey, let me tell you, that was a pretty easy show for me.
It was just as good.
God. So I think there's some good stuff. I think for those seeking to understand, like IQ did, he said, I'm starting to read the New Testament because I'm trying to understand the mindset of Christians. Why are they so anti-Israel? And that was the purpose of what I wrote in those chapters, was to understand the mindset as how people embrace lies. What causes them to do so? And so, you know, being able to talk about that today, I do think that as members of Yah's family, we are all going to gain insights that help us be more effective witnesses against evil and for the truth by the insights that are provided there. It's there's some profound insights there.
Well, I'm going to be reading The Last Days this weekend. I've never read it.
Well, by the way, one of the things that you will really, really find the hardest thing of all for me was to copy. I actually typed it out word for word what the religious clerics, the archbishops said and wrote between the time of Constantine and the time of Theodosius. And I have like 10 pages of quotations from them. It'll be the worst thing you ever read.
You
can't imagine how bad it is.
I spent what, 4 months when, this is back in, when I first discovered you through Tracy Hood. I spent 4 months reading Yada Yah. Grew a beard and everything. I was so fascinated. But now you keep adding to it, so I got to go buy another razor.
Yeah, keep on adding to it. There you go. You know, that's funny. All right, my friends. It was a fun conversation. I hope I didn't bore anybody to death with my fascination with the mindset of the beast. But I'm convinced God gave
us very interesting stuff.
I think he gave us these clues because he wanted us to figure it out.
Well, we have to read go back and do the archives again, because sometimes the chat room gets a little
get busy,
distracted. But
well, good night, you guys.
All right, good night.
Shabbat Shalom, everybody.
Yeah, Shabbat Shalom.